The search for yourself is part of the search within yourself. The path there takes us over mountains and valleys, through storms and sunshine, and yet no one can walk it except yourself. Find out how Gaspar and Moira met on their path and were able to walk over mountains and valleys thanks to their connection to art in episode 24 of the Walkie Talkie podcast. Welcome to the Walkie Talkie podcast. It's been a while, it's been a journey, and I've been away from it for a long time, but I'm super happy to be back, not just with one guest. I have two guests in front of me on the couch. One of them is Gaspar. Gaspar shared the journey of doing an acting class, an acting program for 8 months with me together. The other one comes along with Gaspar, and it's a long and good friend from Gaspar, which is Moira. And I'm super happy to have you here, and I'm super happy to have you as my motivation going back into my little hobby, into my little baby podcast. I really appreciate it, and it couldn't be a better day. It's 25 degrees, feels hotter. The island is showing the best side of it. It's summer, it's June. We're sitting in a beautiful space on Vancouver Island, and I would like to know from Gaspar, how do you remember meeting me the first time?
Well, first of all, thanks for having us here and for, allowing me to invite Moira. She's been integral to my own creative path. So I felt that, and because we are doing this film, that she should be here. The first day I met you, what can I say? this stunningly handsome German guy walks in, and I'm thinking, wow, okay, this is like star material. That's what I thought.
Okay.
Yeah. Just like Jason said. I was struck by your handsome good looks.
And, thanks. Thanks to my parents, because they work.
Well, you also take care of yourself. But then as I got to know you, for those of us who don't, know Jan, he quickly was christened with the name Jesus in our group. And it may sound hokey, but it's not. It's an apt moniker or nickname. And I think it really reflected how you care about people, and it really showed. It was a sincere and honest way you have. It's not forced. You just put other people first. It's a beautiful quality.
Thanks. Yeah, it was in our acting school first day in the basement. In September when we met the first time without knowing each other. We didn't know who's actually in that program, right?
No.
So it's kind of like a surprise. The other person we have here today is Moira. And Moira is a long good friend from Gaspar. And I would like to know, how do you remember meeting me the first time? And then we go a bit in where you guys met.
Oh, wow. Now that's a good question. God. Like, I have all these different moments with you. I wouldn't say I can remember the very first time, because probably the first time was all through Gaspar telling me about your rehearsals and your acting, and the very first for family and friends. And so I was like,
I think that was Godot when we
scene showing, yeah.
Right. So then, of course, I'm going, okay, that's so-and-so that Gaspar was talking. Now I remember, oh, there's Jan. Oh, boy.
Well, of course, I primed her. I said, just look out for this gorgeous German who can act in English.
It looks like I can't do that now.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But then it wasn't just, yes, you're very handsome, but it wasn't just that. Like, I just, because for me, it's like, okay, well, yeah, okay, we got, I like the handsome, you know, or when someone says somebody's extremely beautiful, but I want to, especially if it's going to be acting, I want to see like, okay, what, so what are they going to do? You know, what are they doing with that? And so I did really, I really watched you and I really studied you and I just really saw just very involved in what you were doing. Not about, oh, there's the camera or there's the audience, look at me sort of thing. That there was just a real, again, just a beautiful presence of your kind of depth of care and being with the others and that this was important, what you were doing. And yeah, it kind of really kind of was like, kind of raised my respect, you know, because in this world, you know, just seems to me when the emphasis is only on that, just beauty, 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 or handsome, 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 you still want to see what's behind that. And I loved when you played the guitar and that very moving song that at graduation, even though I saw you a number of times in between and I photographed different shows that I went to. Yeah, I was just very moved by just having a guitar and playing and singing so naturally in this world of tinsels and flashing lights and glitter, and it was so heartfelt, the song. And
so maybe I actually showed something behind what everybody can see, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm asking that not to talk about me so much, because I'm asking that because I'm always curious how people encounter things, and this is part of my journey and part of this podcast a lot. I'm always interested and curious how people encounter things, and that can be everything. We encounter so many things, in my opinion, during the day, during life, every second I encounter stuff. Some people never thought about it, so I would like to know what comes up first when I ask you, Gaspar, how do you encounter things, and that can be everything. It can be this fly who just flew by.
Well, for me, I can be in my head a lot, but certain life experiences have taught me about depth, and I think I just naturally go deep over time, but it takes me time. And so I may seem, when someone first meets me, for instance, I should ask you what you thought about me, because I guess I can appear aloof to people, overly cerebral, nerdy, whatever. I'm not really concerned about that so much, because my experience and my emphasis, where I put my energy, is in relationships, and those are usually long-term relationships. I don't do small talk very well. That I leave to my partner, Rob. He's a master. He's charming. People love him. He can be funny. And usually they avoid eye contact with me, especially when I'm with him. I find that he dominates the limelight. But I've never needed to be in the limelight. And even in acting, the camera is something that I'm going to have to get used to, I find. Really, as an actor, you know, being asked to embody a character, and that's what it is really bringing that into your body, you know. But back to your question, yeah, I really find that for myself, you can't know me in a day, you know, and likewise, I don't expect to know you in a day, just like I discovered, as Maura was saying, what a gorgeously sensitive man you are, you know, through your music, through, you know, when you started playing the piano, and not just playing it, but loving it. You know, you played by ear and you played a song I recognized, and it was just so well played, so beautifully and sensitively. And that's when I saw the substance and the beauty.
So would you say you step back a bit and observe?
Definitely. I definitely observe a lot. Yeah. I think with age and with, you know, meeting my partner, I have a volatile personality. Rob has taught me and given me more stability than I had ever experienced in my life up to that point. I call him my rock, and I feel like the wave crashing on it. So that sort of encapsulates our dynamic. I'm constantly crashing against that rock, and he is usually immovable.
And would you say, doing life, did you change the way of encountering people or things or approach things?
Oh yeah, I think as a young man faced with a terminal diagnosis, it was live for the moment. That was my motto. Mm-hmm. So there was, I wouldn't say little chance for this kind of depth that I'm talking about, but I realized early on how important human relationships were to me, and how important my friends were, my family. Even though my mother and father had a hard time dealing with the knowledge that I was both gay and HIV positive. Mm-hmm. They still stood by me. You know, love in our family was, I wouldn't call it unconditional. They provided for us. Mm-hmm. And that was how my father saw his role as a provider. And my mother, I think she just by her example, she was a very creative woman, an absolutely amazing cook. Whatever she set her hand to, she would do well. But she never found satisfaction in any of that. She never really found herself. And I think, well, her alcoholism had a lot to do with that. But again, I tend to digress too. So getting back to the question of how I approached, you know, life as a young man, it was really colored by this early HIV diagnosis and this live for the moment attitude.
So, that definitely had an impact on how you approach, how you encounter things. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, for sure. It is the soil out of which I grew. It was my spiritual awakening.
Yeah.
Yes.
We will go in there again, don't worry. But I would like to hear about Maura. How do you encounter things?
How do I encounter
whatever comes up in your mind? Can be people, can be animals, can be nature,
can be
air, whatever you feel is coming up there.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think I had an answer, and my immediate answer right at the moment was when we got out of the car here. Oh my God, I just felt like what I remember in childhood, because when my parents immigrated from Ireland, we lived out in the country, and I just loved leaving the house. And I remember, this is like when I was like probably like four, and I just loved walking around and singing to myself and just looking at everything, like, yeah, just taking it in, just taking things in. And even happenstance, like I remember there was like, it seemed at the time a long ways away, but like a neighbor. And at the time, she was to me an old woman that lived in this house. Mm. And her letting me come in, she saw me and just being a kid and the smell of the house. And she had these favorite little candies in a tin box, and they were raspberries, and having one. And I think, realizing looking back, like I was so keenly and loving observing, just like watching her, not in any kind of criticism or, but just, yeah, the way she looked, the way she was walking around, the way she was talking to me. Like I just really found it so engaging. And even though I guess I'm probably more in the middle now, like I used to be like a real, very, very shy and an introvert. So it wasn't that I didn't like people. And of course I still like people. I do like my solitude, but I get very charged just meeting people and the way they tick and what they say and the way they look, how they carry themselves around. Of course, I have my comparisons, like, oh, that's really, I like that about that person. I'd like to be more that way. Or yeah, it's just very engaging. I just really find that so stimulating. We're all so different. And yet we're not, but we're also different.
Yeah.
You know, it's so great.
And that's interesting, but that's why I like to ask questions. It's a unusual question. I don't know if I never asked myself that before I did this podcast, but I figured out it's an interesting question because you can, you just think how you think actually while you encountering things, whatever that means for any person, it can be so different. So let's, I will ask you, you encountered this guy at one point in your life. Give us a little, tell us a bit about who is Gaspar.
Who is Gaspar?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Gaspar is, he's many things. It's, I think it was good that you went first and, you know, gave a pretty, like some, not all of you at all, but some of your, you know yourself and you know some of the things that you said today here, like are very true. But at the same time, you're just one of those few people that I can really have those really deep, heartfelt talks about stuff that really is going on inside that you can't, that is, and it's not that, there's even maybe people that want to listen, but they just don't really get it because they just don't, the way their DNA, their whatever, they're not designed that way. It's like, oh, you're getting too heavy. Woo, you know? So Gaspar and I have always been able to like really share our angst and
bring it on.
Yeah. And, but really, but a very heartfelt and, Gaspar is so caring and very, the opposite of some of the things you said there, like very, can seem, cool or maybe like kind of preoccupied or impatient.
Well, first impressions I talked about, you know, I don't care about how people perceive me in the short run. I mean, people have all sorts of judgments, so I have my own. And I love it when I'm confounded, when somebody proves me wrong, that I may have, I'm sorry to interrupt here.
No.
you know, it's the short run doesn't concern me. I'm in this for the long run. Relationships are my focus. So you can't know a person in a few minutes or a few hours or a few days, maybe even a few years. Yeah. I mean, Rob continues to surprise me.
Because we change.
Yeah, I surprise myself.
Right? Yeah.
You know. So. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. Yeah. I think what I wanted to say, and thanks for saying what you said. I think for me, probably way back, it was a little bit scary because I didn't
meeting me.
When that first part, like describing, kind of intense or preoccupied or a little bit more like afraid, sort of like when you like someone or you're intrigued, but then it's like, oh, maybe they don't want me, I didn't know how to kind of react. Mm-hmm. But then it just, I guess, you know, there was things though that we were doing and around creativity that were already like kind of already really, the seeds were there, you know, that, it was still a natural to with our friendship.
Can you describe him and give him three words? Who's Gaspar in three words?
Passionate, intense, complex.
That's nice, thanks.
Gaspar.
Oh, good.
Who is that person sitting next to you?
Maura is, I've said it before, she's the consummate muse. You know, when she meets someone right away, it's like, I don't know, it's like a mole. She digs down under that skin and wants to know who they are. And she just naturally inspires because she has integrity. She's tough as nails, but in a very gentle way. Mm-hmm. Curious, and yes, complex also. And I think, yeah, in certain ways, there is just this understanding between us. And I don't know if it, like when I first met her, I saw that, or I don't think I even intuited it. I wasn't at the point where I even thought about such things. But early on, because of this, you know, facing my death, there came, I started therapy, and that led me down this path of psychology as a way, I didn't know it at the time, but psychology opened me up to spirituality. And I have a deep respect for psychology done well. And again, psychology not in the modern day industrial sense, which is to make people functional and get them working again. Maura has intimate knowledge of that through her experience with certain corporations in Calgary when she was working as a counselor. For me, my connection to psychology literally saved my life.
Where did you guys meet first time?
I had graduated, well, I knew Maura through a mutual friend, Wes, and you know, we'd sometimes attend parties together and see each other, and we're friendly that way.
Can I interrupt too? Long as you're saying that, remember you were finishing your degree in geography at UC, and you were just hating it and trying to get through it. And I gave a public talk at the Nickel Arts Museum, and it was on creativity in the formative years of childhood. And at that time, I had a slide carousel, and it was all about growing up. I come from a blue-collar family, and you know, events, and very personally revealing of how that connected to the kind of artwork that I started doing. Mm. But you came to that talk, and then it wasn't too soon after that you asked me about teaching you drawing, and boy, did that start a relationship, getting to know each other.
So, you know, the way we met was at these parties, and then what pulled me in was Maura's passion for art. And in my last year of university, I started taking art courses and realized too late that, oh, I should have done this, because it just spoke to me, and I could speak through art. Photography grabbed me.
Why too late? For what?
Well, because I switched several times. I switched majors in university several times. When I first went, you know, my father wanted me to go directly into university from high school. I wanted to work. We butted heads on the subject, and eventually, because I was attending to what my first therapist called my gay career, which is basically, you know, screwing around and drinking, you know, discovering myself as a young gay man, and, you know, looking for that. I was always looking for relationships, and was never happy with one night stands, whatever. So it was the art. And at the time I was almost 30 years old and already feeling like, you know, coming late to the table with this, or finding the path.
Yeah,
as I used to call it.
Yeah.
With Mora, I realized there. So again, that's when the intuition kicked in. Is okay. Here was a person like my therapist who had that some kind of power I desired, a power that emanated from within.
That's from within too.
Pardon me?
That's from within too.
Yeah. So it was an unmistakable energy that was authentic. It spoke the truth. And it was unafraid. And, well, I shouldn't say unafraid. I mean, you know, Warren and I have plenty of fears. But undaunted might be the better word. The determination to create is constantly challenged in our world. And I saw that in Mora. I saw that integrity early on, and it inspired me. And I knew that I wanted to. I asked her, would you teach me drawing? Because for some reason, you know, I just felt that drawing was the basis of all art, and I had to learn how to draw. I could not call myself a visual artist if I could not draw.
Yeah.
For me, drawing was the basis.
And I have to, just on that about the drawing, there's the irony here, is because my work was considered very crude, somebody that can't draw at all. I hated drawing in school. I hated sitting in front of a model at school. And I did an undergrad of 4 years, and then I did a master's in Missoula, Montana, and struggled with drawing all the way through, never liked drawing, never really was good at drawing. And I think a lot of it was repressed, and whatever the fear was, but the work was going in this other direction. So when I was at that level, and so Gaspar, it was such a gift here, because when you asked me to teach you to draw, it was like, oh, fuck, I don't even really know how to draw. That's not really right. What I do. And, but I guess I just trusted. And I did want to learn how to draw. But I knew drawing from a different perspective anymore. It's sort of like, I guess, you can draw really well, but you're mechanically, you're great at drawing, but what is your subject? Are you moved by it? Or do you just walk away from it? The same like playing the piano. You know, if it's like so technically perfect and there's nothing heartfelt that's going into it. Well, what's the point? What's the point of learning that skill? So it was always about the combination of the two. Yeah, and so you taught me to draw because you wanted to do the classical book from beginning to end of, what was the name of the, it's the...
The Natural Way to Draw.
The Natural Way to Draw. It's a beautiful historical book, really. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my God, oh no. And so we did that. We did that. And there's lots of stories in between doing that whole book.
But that's interesting because I think, and I figure that out every day now more and more, that while I'm teaching and coaching, whatever I do, is it soccer, drama, life, whatever, counseling, I learn so much from that as well. Like, it's not a one way road. I'm taking with the people that surround me, helping them, whatever they want to achieve. It's like, it's going back and forth. Like, they teach me so much without knowing, and that's the beauty of it.
Right? Yes.
And then you said that you were like maybe scared, like, how do I teach that? And at the end you figured out, well, just try it, and I learned more than I expected.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. The relationship pulled out more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you open to that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you ever draw a picture of yourself in your mind or an imagination of how your life would look like now when you were younger and had the diagnosis of HIV and kind of like had this, let's talk about it. When did you figure out you like man instead of woman, or you gay?
Oh, that was pretty early on. I mean, I was attracted to male teachers in the fourth grade. I didn't know what it meant, but visually...
So you have that feeling, but you don't know what it is? Or you have that, or you feel like...
It was a feeling. It was just... my fourth grade teacher, Mr. Quilliams, he was a pretty hairy man. And I remember being fascinated by his hairy arms. Just, I looked at it and I thought that was what you'd call beautiful.
Yeah.
And maybe because of the distance between my father and I, I mean, I know my father loved me, but he couldn't express that in an emotional way. And I was always searching for that from the men that I would meet. And I was always attracted to men who were usually at least 10 years older than me,
mm-hmm.
who had experience, what gay men call a daddy. Mm. But I don't like that term anymore because, it can be cliche and it's sort of become a trope in gay culture and doesn't really reflect the depth of the relationship that can be shared between a younger man and an older man, which is a very Greek concept. You know, Greek men were always taking younger lovers and mentoring them. So that kind of mentoring, I realized that it didn't need to be a man. And in fact, I have those deep relationships now with women who continue to mentor me.
Mm-hmm.
Maura is not the only one. Since I've met Maura, I think it was that first fateful meeting with my therapist that sort of set the ground for my, and of course my mother before that. Gravitating to strong women has been a theme in my life.
How was your experience in, like you said, you were really, really young when you figured out you were gay. Was there a day you looked in the mirror and said, like, oh yeah, I have to call me gay now because I like those things? Or how's that happening and how did it affect your relationships in that time?
Well, growing up Catholic, of course, I mean, it's...
Me too.
How did in Brideshead Revisited Charles Ryder describe it? I'm referring to the book by Evelyn Waugh, searching for experiences high on the list of forbidden items. That's what it felt like, forbidden, but yeah. deliciously forbidden.
Mm.
And I couldn't deny it, and I wouldn't. I went for it. And I went for it blindly at a time that was dangerous to your health. But I almost walked into it.
And when you say dangerous, what's the danger?
Well, having unprotected sex. I continued to have unprotected sex at that time. As I was living for the day, I was drinking, I was smoking. There were no drugs at that time.
Hmm.
When I was brought in to the specialist, the HIV specialist at the time in Calgary, he basically showed me a chart with a downward sloping line from left to right and a timeline of 2 years. And he says, this is your life.
How old were you when you figured that out?
I was 21.
So it was 21. How did you figure out that you have HIV?
Now that's another funny story, because I had recently moved back home after spending a year. This was after I had had the rupture with my dad over university and not wanting to be in school and wanting to work. And so I went to work for a year, and I had just moved back home because I wanted to save some money. And I wanted to, my goal then was to work for the airlines. I wanted to travel. So I thought, well, you know, if I worked for an airline, I could really travel more easily. So I set my goal to, I signed up for a vocational school where they taught travel. And, you know, I imagined I would become a travel agent. And
you draw the picture?
Pardon me?
You draw the picture of being a travel agent.
Yeah, I started imagining myself as a travel agent.
Yeah.
And I knew I could do it. I was, you know, I was fascinated by the airline industry from a young age, and never imagined myself as a flight attendant. But I did it. Complete that schooling, and then I immediately got hired on with KLM in Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
In their office, in their downtown offices, not at the airport. And that led to, because it was 1987, Calgary was gearing up for the Olympics.
Yeah.
And airlines were looking for people at the airport. And so I went to apply there and I got a job. And so I got my goal there. I attained my goal, and through that, I started traveling, and I've forgotten your
yeah,
question.
Yeah, it's fine. How did you figure out that you have HIV?
Oh, right. Okay, so back.
We're still on the path.
So we're gonna go back. We're gonna go back a year. So in 1986, I attended Expo 86 in Vancouver with some close friends. And most of it's a haze because I was drunk so often. And of course, that led to quite a bit of sex. And I can't say for certain, but I believe I picked it up there. And a few months later, I got what they call the HIV flu. And you get these flu-like symptoms, and it knocks you on your ass. And I woke up one day and just started doing dishes. And this was after I had recovered. And then I just started crying. And I don't know why, but part of me must have known.
Wow.
And I was deathly afraid of going in for the test, but that day I went in and got tested, and it came back a few weeks later positive.
Well, how did you receive the message?
No, I went into an STD clinic and specifically asked them not to send the results to my family doctor because he was also the doctor of my parents. And he was quite religious. And through some bureaucratic error, it did get sent to him. And he had me in after office hours one day and gave me the news and told me that if I didn't tell my parents, he would, because I was a threat to him, them. So he gave me an ultimatum saying that he would tell them if I didn't.
So you're 21.
Yeah.
Diagnosed by HIV.
Yeah.
The doctor's telling you, if you don't tell your parents, I will tell your parents.
Yeah. And I had just recently moved back home.
Can you describe the feeling you had when you was in his office or in this situation? Like how...
Oh, well, yeah, I almost felt...
And you didn't have the result of like, this is your life there, or you already had that there, like you have two more years.
Yeah, it felt like falling from a great height and... shrinking at the same time. Just literally looking at death in the face and feeling that coldness this shrinking feeling.
Mm.
It was horrible. Mm. It was horrible, like a door opening, and I had to go through into the darkness, and then it shut behind me. And I walked out of that office, and the sun was setting, and I remember just standing there on the street, in the middle of the road, looking into the sun, directly into the sun, for like minutes.
Oh God.
And that the sun sort of burned my eyes. I went directly to my sister to tell her at her workplace.
Did you control it? This move, like this action to look into the sun, or was it just, do you...
No, I was in a daze. Yeah. And, but I do remember that, that feeling, because I was just numb.
Mm.
And when I saw my sister, of course, then I began to cry. But it was more because I was in a panic, because I told her I didn't know how to tell mom and dad.
Mm.
And it's funny how, you know, you're faced with your death, but then you're more concerned about how your parents are going to feel. You know, that's mm-hmm. what impressed upon me the influence our parents have on us.
That's crazy.
You know,
yeah.
the godlike influence of our parents, yeah. That you put your own death aside and you're more concerned about what they're going to think.
Because they decided that you are alive, that you are a human being.
Right? Yeah. So it's an odd, I only thought about that later.
It's an interesting thought.
Eventually I realized, you know, it through years and years of therapy, you know, being able to stand up for yourself in front of your own parents, how difficult that is, how difficult it is to speak your own truth to your parents. And I think again, that's another experience that ties me to Maura, because we share that experience of how influential your upbringing and your early experiences in life are.
And just quickly, just on that, what you just said there, it reminds me of, and it wasn't at all connected to this devastating, you know, time period you're telling me, but just the whole thing with family. And a lot of my early work, well, not, I shouldn't say early, for many years, has been keeping dream journals. And there was one dream in particular that I ended up doing this very, it's a bit like a very severe kind of black and white lino cut. And I just call it dream after a family argument. And my father was very, very stern. And there was also just, you know, that kind of atmosphere where you didn't stand up or have opinions or you'd be really put in your place. And all the dream was the feeling after, like, maybe having an argument or confronting something. And the dream was a hand that had been, like, completely cut, the wrist here. And so the hand is just hanging like that. And so it's called just dream after a family argument. So but when you see it, it feels more like a castration, like a severing. It's such a psychic annihilation that I guess, you know, for better or for worse, that how blood is so tied together, how much we're influenced by our families, for better or for worse, in both wanting to be so loved by them and yet also to be separate from them and to be able to be your own person. Anyways, go ahead there.
I would be interested because you said you traveled a lot when you were young.
Yes.
And then you came back. How important was that for you to go away, to spend time on your own somewhere?
Oh, wow.
How long was your, like, give us a little bit of a...
That's a really good question. And of course, the answer, I didn't know at the time that I know now.
Yeah.
At the time, it was, I finished in Ontario, you went to grade 13 high school. And I had also failed. I didn't do well in school at all. It was just a problem all the way through. Not being a problem student or a child or whatever, but just so shut down and not being able to learn and just never did well in school. I always just got by. And I was always worried, always studying too hard and getting nowhere. And my report cards always says, tends to daydream too much. Maura tends to daydream too much, year after year. So when grade 13 ended, that was the era of, you know, really like the Beatles, that whole heightened hippie kind of, which I didn't really get because I was a Catholic good girl. I wasn't out there popular or... Yeah. You know, wearing the embroidered jeans and all that stuff. But it was all around me. But I, through a conversation in a bar in St. Catharines called the Mansion House when I was 18, there was this fellow that, oh, I thought he was so cute. Paul Gettler had gone to Europe and come back and told me all about traveling in Europe. And in that moment in my mind, I thought, oh, that's what I'll do. Because I didn't want to go to university. I wasn't confident to go. I didn't have good marks. I didn't even know what I wanted to do. I just did not know. So I just decided that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to Europe for a year. Of course, it was a huge, oh my God, the fighting and the, you're going to come back pregnant, Jesus Christ. Don't be calling us, and you know, Jesus Christ Almighty. And just, so of course it just freaked me out more about going and all that.
So you want to go even more.
Yeah, eventually, yeah. So now looking back, that trip was so incredible that it was the beginning. And I give this talk many, many times, over and over, public talk, and I call it In Search of My Best Life. Because that was the beginning of kind of quenching this thirst just to follow my nose. And I didn't even have a map. And I'm not really great with direction. I follow my nose and end up down goat paths because of it, that always have been to my advantage. Mm. And yeah, I just could really, I could fall asleep in the car when I was hitchhiking. Like, I trusted. Mm. And I never had any problems with you know, bad things happening. I just met so many good people and befriended and had, you know, had my, you know, a few real meltdowns at bus stations and train stations. Like, doesn't anybody speak English? Because I would get fed up trying to find my way. But yeah, and everyone would say, Maura, you'll be back in 2 weeks. There's no way you're going to go to Europe for a year. And of course, I started off in England and Ireland where I had lots of relatives. But I got a job in a factory, putting on a factory assembly line, putting parking meter time pieces together. It was all social class, and of course I was working class, and where our lunch rooms were, but it was all young people and all these like Cockney accents. And of course we would go to the bar or to something going on at a college or whatever. And then from there on, you know, I went and worked in a hostel in Amsterdam. And some of the highlights were, all by accident, I worked in an incredible archaeological dig in Tiberias, Israel. And I don't even know how I ended up there. But then I saw a note. It was just thumbtacked, you know, that they were looking for diggers. Mm-hmm. And then I met these two archaeologists, and they were like, for me, they were, oh, wow, like these are really educated, kind of interesting, knowledgeable people. And yes, we'll take you to where the dig is. And then I got my room and board, and it was right on the Dead Sea. And there was young people from all over the world. And yeah, I mean, they had these, they were called kind of Arabs back then, but they had these big black tires cut in half, big, those big trucking tires with ropes drilled into the holes in the sides of the tires. And then they just kind of lower them, and you'd be sitting all day with a person with a crude utensil and just throwing it, because it had to be soil and all, and not try not to break anything. And so you'd have these long conversations with people, and
kind of like meditation, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was just, oh my God, there was a show that was really popular. It was called The Avengers in England. And the writer of that TV series lived on a boat in Corsica. I was living in Ajaccio. No, not in Ajaccio, actually. I got a job in a very high-end resort hotel called the I don't know, like La Hacienda or something. Mm-hmm. But I would go into Ajaccio, and I don't know, just happenstance ended up there was a party going on in this tavern, and I went into it to get directions, and this John, and then with all his, you know, followers or friends or whatever, hey, are you American? No, I'm Canadian. Oh, come over. And then I had you know, a drink and lunch, and he was with his new wife, and they had a child. And so we had just a shack in Ajaccio where he did his writing for the TV series in London, and lived on this just casual, really nice little boat.
I love that show, The New Avengers.
Oh, really? Well, yeah, it was just...
This was the 70s?
Yes.
Yes, that's The New Avengers.
He literally had, like, a net, and we get lobster and cooked, and... Oh, my God, those were such happy moments. It's just the freedom, like, because my family, you know, that's their formative years, too. They were very Catholic and very restricted, even though there were signs that, like, my mother should have been an actress or painter or something. I mean, she was not born in the right time period, and so mm-hmm. she was very unhappy. And my dad hated his job, too. You know, he worked in a pulp and paper mill, and... It was always you gotta work so bloody hard, Maura, for everything. Money doesn't grow on trees, and life is difficult, and work is horrible. And And
you have to do it.
You have to do it. And that there's no such, you know, there's no such thing as work having being enjoyable. Like, I grew up that was none of that. So, I mean, I guess just following my nose going to Europe and that whole world of experience and being in the moment and seeing how other people were living too and working. Mm. All was, even though I didn't know, it was all trickling, absorbing in there. And without getting, and then a last part, and then we'll go back to you, Gaspar. When I was leaving after that year, I felt like I was completely changed. I felt really liberated. I felt so different. I mean, I went a virgin, I came back a virgin, but I met two different beautiful young, you know, to me, we were both boys and girls, like just teenagers, and just had beautiful, innocent love and never being popular, never having that. The trip was so complete and so everything. Mm. And then, you know, I came back. And it's weird how traveling, you just want to keep it in a jar. Mm. Because it goes away. And I found, like, going back to my family and going back to St. Catharines and getting all repressed and small again. And, the hair on your legs is blonde because I didn't shave it anymore. Mm. I just, you know, I'm not going to shave my hairy armpits. I'm going to be, you know, and then all of it was back again. It was all like, oh, well, what's that? And, you know, anyways, this story goes on, but.
I think because you took that experience to get where you are or where you went through and now you are here.
Yes.
And it's a big part of your life. Like all our experience is a big part of our lives. So, we have two beautiful souls here sitting on the same couch, having a long story behind them. How do you guys think? What's the one thing which brought you together?
Living a meaningful life. I mean, many different things contribute to that. But I guess specifically, it would be living a meaningful life through one's creativity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, creativity is central to that. I mean, we have relationships. I like to say that my partner needs three things. He needs me, he needs his family, and he needs his home. And he is satisfied with that. That's not enough for me. As important as my relationships are, there is a need for me to express my inner life. And I think that's why I find acting so compelling. Whereas my experiences with visual art didn't provide that for me. It didn't provide the necessary combination of factors that I sought. I was always looking for movement in art, in visual art, but it's by nature still,
mm-hmm.
when you look at it.
Mm-hmm. Even sure. though you've created some very, very beautiful pieces that will live on.
Well, thank you. But, yes. I'm talking about the experience, you know, just I found that, sure, art, you know, art can be musical, art can be very, there can be lots of movement in art, but I wanted it coming from my body. I wanted to be in a better relationship with my body. Mm. I had abused my body for so long, and as I matured and realized, you know, what my body had put up with and that it's carried me this far, I felt a certain kind of just, it was both gratitude and guilt for what I had put my body through.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not separating my body from myself, you know, I mean, the two go hand in hand, of course. I mean, but I wanted something more from art where that would allow me to both express this inner life through some kind of movement, expressive movement, my voice, and also collaboration. That I knew that what as far as art went, I was always most happy when I was collaborating with people. So,
didn't you tell me that with the collaboration that when you were a kid, you wanted to go to Market Mall and shake hands with as many people as possible?
Well, yeah, that was
a... But that's a quite a... That's quite a... Like a, like when you're that young and you, that's in... Oh, that fervor. Like, yeah, that's a... Yeah, that's a real sign point of who you are.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was... there was a Guinness Book of World Records promotion going on at the mall to drum up business, I guess.
And, I didn't see it.
It was at a local mall in Calgary, and I was 9 years old, and I thought, maybe I'll shake people's hands there and shake the most hands in the world. So I was walking through the mall and shaking.
But isn't that art, being that creative in your head, like a child, and think about things like that?
It was short-lived because the manager soon tired of me disrupting the shoppers and shook my hand twice and disqualified me. So I went home crying. And but yeah, I mean...
You like working with people.
I do.
You like collaborating.
I enjoy working creatively with people.
Mm. What would you say, what's the thing connecting you? Why did you guys met, and why are you there? What is the one connection you said? What did you say? Like the having a
mentor?
No, a meaningful life.
A meaningful life.
Whatever.
And centered on creativity. Yeah.
Would you relate to that?
Oh, for sure. I think right from the beginning it was like, you're just getting to know someone, I'm getting to know Gaspar, and we both clicked on the angst,
mm-hmm.
you know, the angst of, you know, things you're sharing about your life. And then when I met you, Gaspar, I'd already finished art college at that time. And I had gone through so much of that. I mean, I still continue to, but I mean, I know that I'm on my path. But I was able to really share. It was like two outsiders, two likable outsiders.
That's the outsider.
And to me now, great misfits, but yet that's what it's all about, like to... with being art, trying to go your own way as artists. And yeah, I think just when you have that in common, you have that validation from each other, and you're at the same time, when I just said that whole thing about, you know, with Europe and all that traveling I did, like the meaningful struggle continued for me, because I still didn't know what I wanted to do. And I still didn't want to go to university when I came back from Europe. And I was still unhappy. So that took me till I was 35, from 18 till I was 35. I did every job under the sun. I'm not kidding. Laying sod, fish sorter, chambermaid. Honestly, the paragraph is this long. I've got it in a short kind of monologue of all the traveling and all the jobs that I did. And I have many great stories about those jobs and the people I met. But then I would get bored. the job then would lose, I'd lose interest. I wasn't stimulated anymore. And, you know, the people, like, I wanted more. And I knew there was more in me, but I didn't do well in school. I didn't know what I could do. And so it was a search, search, search. And then, this isn't really getting off on a tangent, but what happened was I ended up in Vancouver and I was only 23 and I had been working up as a camp cook up in way outside of Inuvik, like way out in the middle of nowhere. And I just hated that job and ended up taking a flight to Vancouver because people told me more of Vancouver is like a really moderate, warmer place in Canada. If you don't like the cold, go there. So I flew there and, you know, got off the bus in Vancouver. At that time, the YWCAs were great. They were very cheap. Where's the local YWCA? I got the directions and I went there. So the long and short of all that was Vancouver was right for me and I liked living there. And I started doing tons of jobs, different ones. You know, do it for a while, I get fed up and get another one. So finally, I got kind of a good government job. And in that job, they had a fitness program. And I had been good at track and field when I was young, but there was never any encouragement. So not that I never was going to become an athlete or anything, but so then the Workers' Compensation Board that I worked in, they had a film department, which was so great. It was so not like the rest. Everyone was there because they were getting rehab for cutting trees down and, you know, insurance policies. And so, but I end up, which was great. I mean, it was like, wow, the person in human resources saw creativity in me, obviously, to even put me in this kind of esoteric place in the basement with the Workers' Compensation Board to work with a bunch of people to create safety films. And we had so much fun. I had to play the nurse and, you know, wear your hearing when you're doing chainsaw safety. And
there's an actor here too.
Anyways, so they had a fitness program. I'm saying this very quickly because I didn't understand it, but I had to go home, a very difficult disappearance of my mother who committed suicide. You're not supposed to say committed suicide anymore. You took her life. And I came, it shook my world upside down. Very much in what's going on with Marshall in a very different way, but same. And I was very depressed. I went back to work at the Workers' Compensation Board. And then I eventually found out within that corporation, they had a fitness program. And I just went from, I don't have that problem anymore. It's more than my health now. I was, you know, maybe 10, 15 pounds. People would think I was sort of overweight. It was never, anyways, you know, gray sweatpants, just go to the back of the class, go to an aerobics class and just, anyways, I started going and I got a lot of praise that, you should take the program more. I think you'd be a really good teacher. And I was, so anyways, the long and short of all that, I got super, super fit. Like I back then there was Lisa Lyons and Arnold Schwarzenegger, the women empowerment for women, bodybuilding. I never wanted to do bodybuilding, but I did weights. I ended up teaching aerobics.
I have to say, I just have to interject here. One of my favorite pictures of Maura, she's got her elbow on her knee and she's lifting up, you know, I don't know, it's a 25 or 30 pound barbell, but she's just like this. And it's just so beautiful. And I mean, she looks like an Amazon.
Oh, thanks, God. I mean, I am rude. I look back now, I think, oh, wow. I mean, and fitness, and just that intensity of, you know, music and really working out. And, oh, my God, I just loved it. I really loved it. it got me over my mom's terrible suicide. And then I, as time went on, and it gave me so much confidence, the teaching and looking fit and good. Still always questioned my how I look and beauty and all that, but I decided to start taking courses at night. And so distant sort of from art, like I took how to paint fruit on wood plaques called toll painting in a mall. I didn't want to do anything that's like high art or anything, like just, you know, really remove myself from like more craft. And then I joined a rock hound club, and I liked all the rock hounds, and they were collecting rocks and making jewelry out of it, but it was more their personalities and connection with them and just relaxing. And then I thought, okay, I started really making a lot of jewelry and lapidary and learning silversmithing. I took a course at night. And actually, I was also at another club and I was doing photography, and I started taking all kinds of photographs and working in a dark room and developing those, which really was more of my calling. But at the time, I thought, I've got to quit this government job. I can't do this forever. I've got to get some education. I only have high school. So I did a program at in Vancouver called VVI, Vancouver Vocational Institute, learning how to make jewelry. And I got into, and I put a portfolio together, and I got into George Brown College in Toronto. And it's kind of sometimes, see, like the photography felt right, but I thought, oh, there's a million photographers. I'll never make a living from that. No, I'll do the jewelry. I wasn't doing really good in the jewelry, but that, no, that's practical. I can sell it and I can, you know. So when I went to George Brown full time, it was full of like the most skillful master jewelers. 0.005 on your design is off, Maura. You're going to have to now stay to the regular design you've made here, but it's not going to work. And, you know, like interlocking bracelet clip, you know, like locks. And it was so...
So formula for art.
Oh my God. And I didn't have a knack for it.
Yeah.
Like there was, God bless him. In the, in my class, the teacher, his name was George Bitter. And boy, was he bitter. He was an exceptional German goldsmith. Oh my God. His, it wouldn't be stuff that I would want to wear or buy. But in terms of the level of design and craftsmanship and everything, like he was just brilliant. He was brilliant, and he was a terrible teacher. He was a horrible teacher, kind of summed us all up first day. Like he took us out for a beer and lunch and just said, you're going to make it. You won't, including me. You won't, you will, you won't, you won't, you won't. So that's, so it's the fear of God.
Did he say you make it or not?
No, he said you wouldn't make it. Yeah.
Happy first day.
Happy first day. Yeah, anyways, and the long and short of that was, see, here we go. Like this whole thing, when you're trying to find your place in life, and you're still not trusting intuition, you're still trying to be practical, because you have to survive, and you have to make a living, and find ways to make money. And so the year was a disaster, even though there was some very powerful things that happened. I ended up leaving. I finished the year. Like I would not quit. I'm not like that. But there was two things that happened. I saw a counselor for the first time in my life, which I'd never done before. I was so desperate and so unhappy because Jerry Bitter was so abusive. He was a terrible instructor, like really honed in on me for some reason. I was older than the other students, but not by a lot. But back then I was, like early 20s, and I was Yeah, I was 34. I don't know why you want this so bad. Why you're so well liked in the class and you want this. What is it you want? And so there was like this antagonist kind of teacher-student relationship.
Do you still think about this question?
Well, I understand more now what was going on. Hmm. But I've had to put up with the many others on my path where I end up getting myself in these with not all. I've had some incredible later when your values are aligned.
Mm.
When your values are aligned, all of them, you meet the right people that are a catalyst to where you're supposed to go.
Mm.
But when they're not, there are people that come in onto your path and they distract you, they put you down, anyways, there was an enamelist that did these beautiful church chalices, but his name was Alan Perkins, and he's quite old. I mean, he's in his late 70s. And he really, really took me under his wing and just, you know, just said, you know, Maura. And I did really good work in his class. I was the only class I got A's in because there was freedom in the way you could make jewelry and there was drawing and color involved and whatever. And he said, you know, if you were my daughter, Maura, you are such a fish out of water in this program. I hear you're going to Calgary to see your sister. I strongly recommend you go to the Alberta College of Art and check out the program. You're an artist. You belong in a fine art program. And although I was so flattered and it really was so great to hear, it was, oh God, like be an artist? Like, how am I going to do that? How am I going to make a living? And that's only for people that are like really good and like they show obvious talent and they're... But I mean, I was so miserable in that program. And I did go and see a counselor. And I'm not going to get into that whole story, but he stood up for me. And he was so angry because this teacher had a terrible reputation of doing this to other students. And it was quite a few years after I left, I heard that he got kicked out, that he was terminated. And that's happened 3 times to me with teachers having mental health, authoritative, very problematic as teachers and being kicked out to the program. That's it, I'll stop there. It's too much. Oh my God, I'm on a tangent there.
No, it's perfect because I picked up a line in a song at one time and it says, being a human is arts, so be an artist. And since then, I noticed maybe I have to feed my artist in myself more because I kind of like avoided to look in that artist in myself for a long time and I kind of like kept it away and never felt the right approach to it. And in the last couple of years, I noticed, okay, it's super important to do that because that's part of me. And you guys, you're older than me, mm-hmm. and you have much more life experience. You went through stuff I didn't experience. And I'm happy that I didn't. How do you use the arts or the creativity now to be an artist or to be alive?
Well, for myself, I don't know. I'm really... I don't even know if I like the term artist. Because it just seems to create barriers. And for me, it never helped.
Hmm.
Because, like Maura, I didn't know if I wanted to wear that coat.
Mm-hmm.
because it's a very heavy coat. A very heavy, beautiful coat.
For others. Oh, how could I be that?
Well, yeah, there is that. I mean the intention, you know, the desire, the hunger to express oneself is universal, and everybody does that in different ways. For some, it's family, keeping a family, and mm-hmm. that can be a very creative act that satisfies those people, motherhood or fatherhood. For myself, it always centered around my emotional life. Mm-hmm. And again, that is what drew me to acting again. Being able to show the world this aspect of my inner life. In a way that was, you know, that could be crafted, you know, through character, through story. And again, I guess as much as visual art did feed me in a certain way, and you know, introduced me to, you know, certain concepts, or not even concepts, but ways that, you know, taught me about discipline and persistence, because I've led a very undisciplined life. And I guess I seek some kind of, I've always sought some kind of redemption through art that challenges me to stay with it, learn the craft, and keep with it. And I think that the what makes that doable and enjoyable for me is the collaborative aspect. Right. So
What about this sharing? Is that part of the collaborating aspect? Like,
well, for sure. I mean, you know, what we shared this last year, I mean, that's to me is precious and irreplaceable. It transformed me in ways that I didn't expect. So grateful for the experience.
What about you?
I didn't know Gaspar then, but when I took Alan Perkins, saying go out to Calgary and check out the Alberta College of Art, and I did make the decision, I didn't know like what I was really gonna, where it was gonna go, but because that enamelist instructor loved what I had created there, it was sort of enough to say, okay, well, this is not working with the jewelry making. Okay, I'll go to this fine art college. The second year, I had to change mediums. I was stubborn, and because in college you have to try a lot of different mediums, you can't just specialize in one. I was stubborn and I said, I'm still going to do jewelry making. And they actually, with what I did at George Brown when I went to that college, they gave me extra credits for the level of craftsmanship, which was kind of nice because I wasn't getting good grades over there. So I thought, okay, I'll stay with the jewelry, you know, like by Jesus, stick it out and just work hard and, you know. So, but it still wasn't working out and I hated it and I wasn't enjoying it. And then we have to take electives. So I took printmaking and my whole world just completely changed. I had to learn how to just make my first lino cut, which is like printmaking. And the teacher, instructor, his name is Gary Olson. And at that time when I went there, I was 35. So a lot of the staff were kind of not too, like maybe 5 years older than me, because they went right from high school. They didn't travel. They didn't do all of that. Went to art school, knew they wanted to be artists, and so they got all their training. And I remember they all really kind of liked me because I was really struggling. I was very critical. I never liked anything I did. We would have these critiques because you'd go into a room and put your work up, and they were good to have. They were close and very intimate, like almost a bit like group therapy. And each person would put their piece up on the wall. And if you have a good instructor that, you know, keeps it, you're not there to crucify people, to let them have the space and time to look at their work, describe it, maybe say what's going on. Sometimes people say what's going on in their life. And just that alone, because I mean, you know, jewelry was, you know, 007 off here, and that there was nothing to do about your inner world, nothing. Yeah. And so very quickly, though, like in the very early critiques, I just said, you know, I'm a fake. I'm looking at black and white photographs. I'm drawing. I'm copying images I see in those books, and I'm making this into a print. I don't want to make it like, I don't want to be doing this, but I don't have any ideas. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. And so, in a good way, that's what was so great. I mean, Gary Olson just really listened and heard me. And then after the critique, he said, Maura, so like, what are you interested in, like what do you do when you're not at the college? What kinds of things have
what do you do when you're alone?
Exactly. So I've remembered my dreams since I was a little kid. I know under five, terrible nightmares and other things, and I draw these little doodles. They're awful. I don't know how to draw. They're just like stick people or whatever. Yeah. And he said, well, that, okay. He said, well, bring one of those journals in. I want to see it. So he got me to flip through it, and he goes, okay, why don't you pick that one right there and have it ready for the next critique. So I did it, and I remember it felt really good that, I did something that was from my imagination that was already in this little book. I hadn't looked at anything. I made it into this little lino cut. I was terrible at using the carving tools. My printing was terrible. Anyways, I did all that and brought it to the critique, and then, you know, had my time like all the other students, put it on the wall, and then said what it was. I'm not quite sure right now, this moment, the first one, but close to one of the first ones was, then I did the dream print was 3 pints of milk. So 1 pint and number 2, number 3. So one is totally carved out, so it's white with the black background. The second one is carved, so there's black spots all on the pint of milk. And then the third one is like totally black, just with white outline. And then there's a little head down there in the bottom corner, just kind of like, and I called it Dream Catechism Class, Soul Without Sin, Soul with Venial Sin, Soul with Mortal Sin. And so there was like this huge discussion about it with everyone in the class. Like, it just, you know, there was just this conversation going on, and I thought, and in my mind, it was just like, well, it was nuts, but it was coming out of me, and everything felt so right and so, like, I must be onto something. Mm. So I started doing more of them. And of course, then it brought up a lot of like sadness and things with school, and the, you know, the nightmares were very revealing about lots of things, because we just grew up in a lot of, there was some brilliant, brilliantly amazing things about being Irish. And the Irish are like, they're so bloody funny, and the dramatists, and the, they can act and make something out of nothing, and yet they're cutthroat, critical, and harsh, and unsensual, and you go to hell if you're vain. You know, you after what God's given you, like. Yeah, so it just took off. I got much better with printmaking, and I finally found my place in the world. Like, I found a purpose. I found I was not only making these prints that were very revealing and personal, I was getting really good marks. I was getting opportunities. I had male instructors that weren't, I thought, were flirting with me, and I didn't trust them, that it was just all bullshit. No, that really believed in me, believed in my work. And I wasn't failing anymore. I was doing really well in school. And yeah,
because I mean, you had no judgment.
No judgment.
Right? So there was no, like, you just let it happen.
Yeah. Of, like, and if you,
what's the result?
Yes. Yeah. And this whole thing about, you know, you're on the right path when you just have that meaningful feeling, when it feels so good. Even if you, even for those that don't, haven't got to that point in school or whatever it is, but they're getting these aha, like something that so makes you feel happy, makes you feel, those are the big stations of meaning of your path, that you're getting signs and telling moments of what you should do with your life. Yeah, so, you know, I went on to
I was about to ask about an advice for people who are listening or watching to this, an advice for, like, people who are struggling with using their creativity or, yeah. But, I mean, there was a lot in it. Is there some stuff which comes up when I say, do you have an advice for people who are looking for more meaning, for more creativity in their life?
Well, I actually, with the, what's, I, when I was working for a corporation, I was a family therapist for many years and helping people. And I didn't like the corporation, but the work was rich with the people I met. But when I got, when I built, Marsh and I built my studio, I started seeing people in everything, singing, performance, visual art, and also people that didn't know what they wanted to do with their life, to help them with kind of, you know, it was like with blocks, like something that's stopping them from even trying. And, you know, since then, like, I've seen so many people, and it's very gratifying and very fulfilling. And a lot of the things that I repeat just in helping others to find their creativity is, I am an optimist. At the same time, we are living in, more than ever, in a very, very difficult time period. Every time period for the people that were born into their time period, of course, is difficult and has problems. But we have a whole other, in our time period, a different clusters of challenges. And so the stats are there. I mean, it is like 2% of people earn their living doing anything that's really meaningful. Most people are unhappy. And I think the time period that we're living in too, there's more wealth than there's ever been. The standard of living has never been so high. Really liberal arts education really has gone out the door. And the digital age is here to stay. There's good things about it, but there's other things about it. I'm telling you, all these young ones, when they're in their 40s that have been sitting on a computer all day, even if they're an architect or whatever, it's grueling. You're not out in nature, you're not walking,
I picked up a horrible statistic in another podcast I was just listening to, that the guy said, if we keep going with the amount of time we spend on the screen on our phone, we will spend 20 years of the rest of our lives looking on our phone like this. Just keep going as we're doing it now.
Yes.
Sounds like, shoot.
Sobering.
It really is.
And honestly, I'm probably, anyways, just the way I'm built. I'm, I guess, kind of probably in this day, especially now too, pretty backward and kind of technical, kind of anti-technical. And I have to do it because I have to do it.
Sitting around three cameras, well done.
Yeah, and well, you know, I have to, if I'm going to get my money or if I'm going to pay people, I have to know how to use a computer and all that. Because I do see, I'm getting a little off topic here, but I just, the distractions, the brainwashing that we're all being exposed to on what success is, what that looks like, is so distorting, and it never gives us time. Because we can't help it. We've become so addicted to it that we're no longer doing any self-counsel. Being without all that stimulation, a lot of it can be really amazing. You know, it's coming at us from every direction. So I think.
How do you deal with it? What's your advice then? Like how?
Have it in the studio when I'm working. I
be more disciplined with keeping it away for a while.
Yeah, I love movies. But where it can get bad, whereas like when I was in school, I only had the library. But I have gotten way too hooked looking at art online. And it's like eating boxes and boxes and boxes of chocolates. Because you're just filling up and being so-called inspired, and you've done no work yourself, and you still have to start at your own your own mark making, your own whatever it is, your note, your word. Otherwise, you're just recopying and remimicking everything that's already out there. Or what's great art? What's great music? What's great writing? You know, so I guess for me, I love helping people, it's a two-way, becoming aware of how you're spending your day and your values first. Are they in line? You know, we all have to work, but if you're doing a job that's really, really sucking the life out of you, and a better job is a little bit lower paying, but would ease you to be able to start giving at least 10% a day to something with your creativity, because you would become a little more relaxed. Mm-hmm. You would. But, you know, the candy is always out there. Mm. And, of course, me too. I mean, I love luxury. I love things. I love, you know, but what's the price of my time that's being eaten up and taken from all these different things? I could have maybe taken a job teaching at a college that I already heard was so toxic, and how strict the art is going to be implemented. But feather in my cap, maybe I'll become the. Is that aligned with my values of how? Because my creativity is not going to flourish well and be put first if all these other values are.
If you take it second.
Yeah. I mean, that's a start. That's a starting place. Yeah. Giving ourselves later permission to even get started and keep going.
Yeah, I think you're a beautiful example for people out there. Like, it's never too late to do something like an acting school. Right, so there's.
That doesn't mean that it doesn't come without pain, because starting this late, they keep on telling me, well, there's never like now to plant a tree, yeah, but you still have to deal with the past, and everybody has to come to terms with that. But we're all aging. And age brings with it certain gifts. I'm much more patient than I used to be, much more accepting. Friendship means even more to me nowadays. Connection. So I can bring that to my acting, and I can bring my experiences, my pain, my joy, my all those things that make up my inner life, every time I get the opportunity to act, it is whether it's a painful scene or not. There's just a gratitude that comes with that. Like Maura was saying, when you finally listen to that voice inside that is so quiet and wants to be heard. That otherwise, you're leading this life that is colored by this tension and how did that one writer put it? Quiet desperation, right? Yeah, that's going to continue unless you finally face what it is that you desire, that your heart's desire, to just be honest and look away from the distraction for a bit and listen to that voice. Become quiet and just listen.
Yeah.
What is it telling you?
I was listening to a voice, which was your voice, after I played my song on graduation, and you said you should record this, and I was listening to you, and I decided I listened to you and would do that. So, thanks for that motivation.
I'm so glad to hear that, Jan. That's so great. Yeah. That's so great. Mm-hmm. On what you just said there, Gaspar, I mean, because I beat myself up to like this whole aging thing, and I'm still not where I want to be successfully, and it's still not. But what about the saying, that which I should have done, I did not do? And you know how many people in the cemetery or whatever that are probably too, most people have some, they have gifts or something more of life to live or to be or do, and they never. And I don't say that in a judgmental way. It's just tragic because there's a lot of interference, and support is, everybody needs support, and when we get the right support, we flourish. And finding those kinds of people, I mean, and life has no guarantees. There's always things that still seem to like scratch your head. How come it turned out that way? But it's less, I think the chances then are less of like really going off on that really destructive kind of a self-loathing path of because of a terrible unhappiness and trying to escape. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Darren touched on it in the podcast you had done with him, and he called it this culture of chaos that men that seems to manifest among men, and it's sort of this outer reflection of that inner desperation, and I think that creativity makes soil out of that chaos.
It
doesn't even necessarily bring order to it, but it makes it meaningful.
Yeah,
and that is what is so
it makes something where central. Something else can grow out of it again.
Yeah, that we all have lives like that. Life is chaotic. Our feelings can be chaotic. The way we deal with them or not deal with them. I think when you can bring that to that honest look at that, I mean, yeah, that's what makes movies so compelling and so popular. The stories of fucking up and redemption and longing, hunger for more. Hunger for meaning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was
a pleasure. And
thank you too, Gaspar.
All the best in creativity for whatever comes.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's been wonderful.
Thanks.